That concludes the open public input item on the agenda, and we can move right into the director's report. We're going to make a little switch in the order, but do you want to explain?
Yeah.
Going on here today, one of which is a meeting that Joe needs to attend at 9 o'clock, so we're going to have him start with the budget portion of the director's report first, and then which will be relatively short, I think 10 minutes or so, and then I'll follow up with my portion.
Yeah, and I hope you all will stay around to hear the director's report, because I think it'll address some of your issues. Okay. Deputy Director Storr.
Good morning, Commissioners. Can you hear me?
Yeah, so
you should have two documents in front of you. Again, I'll try to be brief, but wanted to bring you up to date on where we ended up with our operating budget and talk to you a little bit about revenue collected last year, sales, well, actually last biennium. So first I'll start with the budget. As you know, we had a lengthy legislative season. You know, we had the regular session, which was the 105-day session, plus two special sessions. Huge challenges for a new administration and a number of new legislators. We had a split between the House and the Senate in terms of political parties, which added to the dynamics and the debate, and a $2 billion budget problem. You know, probably almost as large as any budget problem that we faced in the last 5-6 years as a state. So the budget passed near the end of June, and we scrambled to understand what happened and to, you know, put budgets in place, activities in place. So turning to the second page on the budget handout, this is for especially for the new commissioners. This is what our operating budget looks like. We are about 44% general fund state and wildlife fund state. State wildlife account is a little over $100 million, and that's generated primarily by fishing and hunting license sales, as well as some other things that we sell. And then the federal local piece of this budget pie is actually larger. If you remember back 4 years, it used to be sort of a 50-50 split between the state funds and other funding, federal and local funds, and now it's dominated more by the federal and local funding. Our total budget's nearly $375 million for the biennium. That supports something short of 1,500 FTEs, and I would note that those FTEs, those full-time equivalent positions, grow. We probably fluctuate by about 200-400 FTEs during the summer season as, you know, temporary and seasonal hires, but these are the permanent year-round numbers. So how did we do with the budget? I think it was on the next page, a very positive budget for us. Looking at that $2 billion problem statement, I was very concerned we were going to see a 5, 10, 15% general fund reduction. That didn't happen. In fact, one of the larger problems we entered the session with was our maintenance level budget, our sort of foundational costs and funding needs. Had grown from cost of living increases and a number of other increases, fish food and leasing costs, those kinds of things. So we submitted 13 what are called budget packages, 13 different areas where we needed funding support, and 12 of those 13 were supported, many with general funds. So we actually got additional general fund in the face of that $2 billion budget problem for maintenance-level activities to support the fundamental parts of the agency. There were no direct program cuts that will impact staffing levels. So we have no layoffs. We have no loss of staff or activities. And I think a lot of this is because we've had a good team in place. We've built some strong relationships with legislative staff, with legislators, the director and a number of other staff, Ann Larson, spent a lot of time working with legislators, as did our assistant directors, Nate Pamplin and Jim Scott and Lisa Veneroso, Bruce Bjork. Those people have worked very hard to build an understanding in the legislature about what's going on. Next page, we continue to see a number of fund shifts. We have had general fund removed, but it's been replaced with other fund sources. That's a trend that's been going on for several sessions. And again, kind of I take it as a positive sign that they don't want us to stop doing the things we're doing. They need general fund, but they substitute it with other fund sources. Moving through the next page, we did actually receive some enhancements with non-general fund dollars to our wolf management. I think we've discussed the $10 increase to new and renewed personalized license plates. We received some additional funding for deer and elk property damage, so we're able to create a broader wildlife conflict management program, and received some fish production enhancements of just short of $1 million for fall Chinook on the Cowlitz and steelhead coho and Chinook at Clark's Creek. Finally, we received funding for a number of facility moves. We moved our fiscal office staff up to the Natural Resources Building and gave up on a building in downtown Olympia here we've been leasing. This provides for a lot more effective coordination between our budget office and our human resources office and the operating programs. The legislature changed directions on some of the properties we own downtown. They directed us to retain ownership of our 600 Capital Way program, where we have our capital program staff located and our real estate program staff located. So we will keep those folks there. And as you know, we sold two other pieces of property per pass direction, and that those funds ended up in the wildlife account. We are going to be moving our Region 5 office, our Vancouver Regional Field Office. Don't know where yet. We're out looking with the Department of Enterprise Services for a new location, and we got about half the funding we need there, so we're going to have to find the other half out of existing operating budget, but we will be moving those folks over the course of the next 2 years. And we've moved our staff from Point Whitney to Port Townsend. That was due to a lot of infrastructure needs at that facility, and this puts them closer to where a lot of the people they work with are. So budget outlook for the future, we're hearing the projections show slow positive growth in the forecast for the general fund. We'll see if that continues, if that actually happens. There's going to continue to be, even if that does occur, lots of pressure on general fund to restore services that have been cut in the past, potentially, or to deal with this McCleary decision, the Supreme Court decision about kindergarten through 12 education and the funding of that. And the debate over new taxes and fees, I expect that will continue too. So all in all, a pretty good budget for us. Probably one of the best if you look back over 4 or 5 years. The other topic I wanted to briefly touch on, I think you enjoy this. It's related to these the colored sheets, and for the audience, these documents are out on the table if you're interested in seeing these. This is a closeout on the biennium, the two fiscal years, in terms of our state wildlife account. Again, those are the dollars primarily from hunting and fishing licenses. And so this report's prepared by Bill Joplin and Frank Holly in the licensing section. I think they do a great job with it. The Wildlife Fund is made up about over 90% of non-restricted dollars. So those are dollars that come in that the agency has a lot of discretion in terms of how we use those. And something approaching 10% in 19, I believe, restricted accounts. Let me orient you to this page. There's a lot of numbers here. In the top, you see in the tan, all revenue sources. That's kind of a, that is a roll-up of the other three sections below that of revenue that's collected. You see the revenue source, you know, fishing, hunting, other, the fiscal year, last fiscal year, and the fiscal year prior to that. We compare them to each other in terms of growth. And then we also forecast. As we, for instance, begin the current biennium, we prepare a forecast, and we discuss that with OFM. We've been criticized in the recent past for not projecting what we think we'll collect. And that allows you to manage and appropriate more effectively. So there's at the bottom of that quarter that of all revenue sources, you see a fiscal year 13 forecast. And then on the right-hand side, you see the last 6 years of revenue collection. Some of the trends that I notice is the growth that we've seen in revenue. You can see the impact of the increased fees in the last two fiscal years in the blue and the orange bars. And then below that, as you go down the page, you see hunting revenue broken down by the various hunting sources, fishing revenue, and then other revenue sources, which could include things like commercial application fees, licensing fees, wildlife diversity, the Discover Pass. Those dollars are all in that other category. So just a couple of highlights. On the second page are some notes. We do some analysis that you can read through. I won't go through all of those. But I think we see that an improving economy and a good supply of species to harvest, especially fish, and a lower than anticipated resistance to the last biennium's fee increases from fishers helped to generate good revenue results. Some interesting analysis around what a hunter pays and what a fisher pays. On average, anglers paid $37 for their angling licenses, while hunters paid $101 for their hunting licenses. We've seen generally increases, small increases in participation for anglers, while 6% decrease for hunters. So especially in the first fiscal year of the last biennium, we saw a loss of about 11,000 hunters associated, we think, with the fee increase, and that stabilized. That didn't continue down the second fiscal year, but we did see some resistance to license purchases as a result of the fee increase. Discover Pass, in some of the numbers you'll notice, that we didn't meet our forecasts. That's because we anticipated larger collections from the Discover Pass than we actually received. And then the last two pages give you details on the collection of revenues by quarter and by various revenue sources, so I won't go through all of that, but I'd give you this. This closes out the biennium, gives you a sense of the last 6 years, and gives you some idea about how the participation and the fee amounts relate. One last thing I'll point on the front page at the bottom right box. You see the blue and the green bars. The blue are the fishing dollars that come in. The green are the hunting dollars that come in. And then you see those horizontal lines. The red line reflects fishing participation. These are individuals. This isn't license sales. These are actual individuals that bought fishing licenses. They may have bought one. They may have bought, you know, six, five. And then the purple line that runs through the green are the number of hunting individuals that purchased licenses from us. And you can see the trends that are that I described briefly. And fishing lines tend to bounce around pink years every other year. But that's interesting too. So with that, I'll try to be brief and stop.
And you need to get to a meeting.
I need to get to a meeting.
Thanks. I think there would be questions, but you need to get to a meeting.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Oh, great job, too. I do enjoy. You made a joke at the beginning. This must be something enjoyable for everyone. Well, I do. I like looking at these numbers. And I think they're well organized. Some of the essence of what you're thinking about the numbers is presented well. Thanks. Okay, Director Anderson.
I think, Madam Chair, if you, it's okay, I'm going to go out to the, I've got a couple of slides on one item.
Okay.
Talking a couple days ago, and I said I didn't think I had very much for a director's report, and then I got started, and I found out I had a little bit more than I thought. So apologize if this is a little bit more lengthy than you were prepared for, but I see that we have until 10:15 and should be able to fit within that time frame. So good morning, commissioners, folks that joined us here today, members of the public. I have a series of different issues I want to update the commission on, including a couple of those that you heard about during public testimony. I want to start with letting you know of some staff changes that have occurred since we met in June. First is Dave Whipple. You may know that name. Dave's representative has been in the Habitat program, has been in the forest and fish arena for a long, long time, and he recently accepted a position in the wildlife program to head up the hunter education program. So we're excited about that, to have Dave in that position. I think it's he's going to be a great attribute to the hunter education program, and as the wildlife committee heard last night, wildlife program led by Nate Pamplin, they're doing some pretty exciting things with the hunter ed program, and they'll continue to coordinate closely with the enforcement program. Our enforcement officers, a number of them, have participated a lot within hunter education and certainly intend to continue that commitment. So we're excited to have Dave on board in that position. The other one that you know about is Jim Brown has taken on the regional director position over in Region 2 out of Ephrata. And so he started officially on July 1, and so we're happy to have Jim there. We had the opportunity to do a round of regional meetings here in the second week of July, and so had an opportunity to sit down with Jim and talk a little bit about expectations and what we're trying to accomplish over there in the next year. And so we're excited about having Jim on board. I think he's going to do a great job coming in behind Dennis Peach, who had a great retirement party here just last weekend. The other position, Chief Bruce Bjork, our enforcement program, as you know, announced his intent to retire, I think on September, I think it's 8th, could be 6th. And so we've went out and did a broad-based recruitment for a replacement for our very important position of being chief of the enforcement program. And lo and behold, right in front of us, we had a great candidate, Lieutenant Steve Crown. And Steve has accepted the position, so he will be moving in as our new chief, coming in behind Chief Bjork, who obviously leaves behind some really big shoes to fill, but we're really excited about having Steve Crown be our new chief of the enforcement program. And Steve, if you could stand up, I think you're back there.
Yes, he is.
So,
congratulations.
Welcome. I'd have the other two stand as well, but they're not in the room, so you wouldn't be able to see them. So, So getting on into some of the meat of some of the issues we're dealing with, I'm going to start with some of the fisheries issues. And I must say, at least from my perspective, getting all of our fisheries management regimes in place this year through the co-management process, working with our stakeholders. This has been one of the most difficult years that we've experienced. That was reflected in part in some of the testimony you heard during public comment. A number of these decisions dragged out longer than certainly we wanted them to, and it is leaving a degree of uncertainty for folks as a result. And I'll try to explain some of the reasons why we find ourselves in that position, and hopefully we can make some changes that will allow us to get out of those kinds of positions in the future. Although, while we do our best, I certainly can't say with certainty we won't find ourselves in difficult positions in the future. So the first one, as I've reported before, our sport fishery in the Puyallup River, and our negotiations with the Puyallup tribe have been difficult. We weren't able to reach conclusion in our discussions during the North Falcon process, which ended around April 9th or so. But we did reach agreement last week after a lengthy set of negotiations that included two meetings with the Puyallup Tribal Council just this month, one that I attended and the other that Pat Fatillo attended. And while we've reached agreement, we haven't reached agreement in total for the entire fishery time frame. We have reached agreement for the August and September time frame, but we have additional discussions to have relative to the October through December time frame. So the Coho and the Chum time frame is the area that we're going to have further discussions. The primary issue that we were dealing with with the Puyallup tribe was related to conflict between sport fishers and the tribal fishers. And frankly, it shouldn't come as a surprise that when you have the banks of a river, a relatively narrow river lined with sport fishermen fishing with hook and line, and you have tribal fishermen exercising their treaty right using gill net gear and drift net gear, that it's those two fisheries occurring in the same place at the same time are going to have some problems. And from the tribe's perspective, to some degree to ours, particularly in August, September, we've had some problems. And I think ensuring that all of our fishers, whether they're sport fishers or tribal fishers, can conduct their fisheries in a safe manner and that we have orderly fisheries is a really important piece. And so the resolution included a greater reliance on separating those two fisheries by time. And that is to say that when in a significant portion of the river where we have tribal fisheries going on, we're not having sport fisheries going on the same day that the tribal fisheries are happening, and similarly, we're not having tribal fishers occurring when the sport fishers are on the river. So that will result in some additional closure days than what we had last year in August and September for the sport fishery. Some of those closures, as well as some closures or reduced opportunity in the tribal fishery, also had to do with meeting our conservation objectives. So at least we have that fisheries, I can't remember when it starts. It starts, I think, the August 16th, I believe it is, 15th or 16th. And so we're on schedule to have that begin. The Skokomish River was another area that was very difficult this year. We reached agreement on Thursday afternoon, July 25th, again after a lengthy set of negotiations that extended obviously far past the end of North Falcon. The primary issues included conflict avoidance, same kind of deal, between the tribal fishery and the sport fishers, particularly in the area above the Highway 106 bridge. There is some tribal hook and line fishery that occurs below the 106 bridge, but we don't have the conflict between different gear types there. And so in addition to the conflict avoidance issues, we had jurisdictional issues dealing with whether the breadth of the river is included within the reservation boundaries, and how the fishery should be modeled to provide a high level of assurance that we would not exceed the ceiling exploitation rate that's called for in our Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan. In addition, the jurisdictional issues brought with it the question of sport fishers needing to obtain a tribal permit before fishing on the river. The resolution to these issues included the tribe agreeing not to enforce its ordinance, which it has passed, that requires non-members to obtain a tribal permit to fish on the river. It included modeling assumptions for the tribal fishery that were not as risk adverse as we recommended. It included an agreement to discuss a third party process to resolve the reservation boundary issue over the course of the next 6 to 8 months so that we're not confronted with the same issue absent resolution when we get to next year's North Falcon process. And I would also say that I think that's a tall order to have that resolved by a third party in that time frame, but perhaps we can make some progress. And it also includes joint enforcement patrols to provide greater assurance of public safety, peace on the river. Sergeant Nixon has been working with his counterpart, the Skokomish tribal enforcement folks, and they've arranged for these joint patrols. And so that's the resolution to the Skokomish River issues. So it's kind of a partial resolution, some resolution to the issues that were specific to 2013, but there's some other issues that are going to need further work. Let me just pause there and ask if there's any questions on either the Puyallup or Skokomish before I move on to the Grace Harbor or Willapaw.
Any questions?
Okay. Grace, let me start with Grace Harbor. The Grace Harbor salmon fishery discussions in this year's North Falcon process were complicated by the weakness of the predicted run of our wild Chinook salmon, which is not necessarily unusual. We've had some chronic problems with meeting our escapement goal for wild Chinook in the Chehalis system, but we had something less than 2,800 harvestable fish to work with, both from a state perspective and a tribal perspective, and the strength of the predicted coho run, which was 140,000. So trying to craft a fisheries that provided access to those abundant coho runs when you have a real weak return of Chinook and the area of overlap there certainly makes it difficult to structure fisheries. The combination of the circumstances certainly made it difficult to meet the expectations of both the commercial and recreational fishers while achieving the spawner objectives. On top of that, that further complicates this is that while we've had a number of discussions with the Quinault Indian Nation to this date, we don't have an agreement. We don't have a management agreement for Grace Harbor with the Quinault Indian Nation. And then an additional complication here is that we have the Chehalis tribe. Doesn't have off-reservation treaty rights, but has rights to fish in the Chehalis River adjacent to the reservation. Again, there's some boundary jurisdictional issues there, but those weren't brought to bear here this year. But getting their share, if you will recall, comes out of the non-treaty share, and that comes from a Ninth Circuit Court decision some number of years ago, 15 years ago or so, where the Ninth Circuit Court ruled that the Chehalis tribe share, given that they're not a treaty tribe, comes out of the non-treaty share. And we've had some degree of difficulty getting data from the Chehalis tribe on what their catch is. And so we're making estimates about that. There was an extensive public process to develop the recreational commercial fishing proposals and rules for Grace Harbor. The testimony you heard from the public correctly reflects that the regulations for the commercial fishery are not final yet. We had five different meetings with the advisors. We had a couple of public meetings as well. I'm not anxious to engage in the he said, she said debate. I do know that on April 15th, so after March 29th, the date that some of the public testimony referenced, that there was a meeting that was hosted by and requested by Ron Warren to talk about the changes from the March 29th meeting relative to the commercial fishery. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, why that happened. I'm also aware that from the technical staff, Barbara McClellan, in particular, that there's been interactions between our stakeholders and her during this last few months. How many? I don't know. But I don't think, from what I'm hearing from staff over the course of the last 20 minutes, is the representation that there's been no communication. That view isn't shared by staff members. Now, the communication that between people in leadership at the regional program manager level, at Ron Warren's level, that's a different topic. I'm not certain about that, and I'm not contesting or challenging what the public testimony was on that in that account. So let me talk a little bit about the rulemaking process, because that, frankly, is the primary reason there's a delay. I think you're all pretty familiar with our rulemaking process. We've essentially got three choices sometimes. One of them is our full rulemaking process. We do a 101, a 102. The 102 includes all the provisions of the proposed rule, the specifics. There's a time frame between the filing of the 101 and 102. There's an additional time frame then when you file the 103, which is essentially the adoption of the regulations. There's a public hearing requirement prior to the adoption of the 103. And then there's generally a 30-day period from the time you adopt the regulations to the time and file them with the code revisor to when they become effective. So that's the standard permanent rulemaking process. There's also a process called the expedited rule process, in which you can, as the name suggests, get rules in place quicker, but you're not using an emergency rule. You're using essentially it's a rule that's put out. There's public testimony provided, but you don't have the same length of time or intervals, so you can put a rule in place quicker. The potential problem with that is if you don't have agreement amongst everyone that's affected by your rule, and you have even a single challenge to an expedited rule that's been filed, you have to stop that process and go through a full permanent rule process. Where we've had agreement where we believe that we've had agreement on fishery regimes, we've used the expedited rule process. But because we knew we didn't have agreement on the proposal. We did not use the expedited rule process and instead are going through the full rulemaking process. So we filed the 102. I don't have the exact date, but I believe it was in June for Grace Harbor that has the specifics in it. That's how the members of the, or at least one of the ways the members of the public understand that what's in that rule and the tangle net piece. We'll have a public hearing on August 6th, so next week, and obviously invite anyone that has comments to make about the proposed rule to participate in that public hearing. And then after that, we would adopt the 103, and we would then have, we have a mechanism to get the regulations in place in a shorter time frame than the 30 days so that we wouldn't have to use an emergency rule process for the start of the season, understanding that in the case of the Grace Harbor, the commercial fishery doesn't start until, I don't know the date, mid-September, I think, but don't hold me to that. So, I'm trying to explain why we're in the situation we are in terms of timing, and the rulemaking processes that we have to select from. Now, in terms of what's in the 102, we have a recreational fishery that has 985 allowable impacts on wild Chinook salmon. The season in what we call Marine Area 22, which is the Johns, typically referred to as that Johns River area, they would be able to fish from September 16th to September 22nd. There's a 3 fish a day limit, but only one of which may be a Chinook. You get up river in the Chehalis, recreational anglers will be able to keep up to 3 salmon a day, again, one of which may be a Chinook, from October 1 through November 30th from the Highway 101 bridge upstream to the Porter Bridge. And then in the Satsup River, recreational anglers will be able to keep up to 3 salmon with the requirement to release wild adult Chinook from September 16th through November 30th from the mouth up to the bridge at Schaefer State Park. So on the Chehalis side, not speaking to the Umtulip side, but on the Chehalis side, where we have the constraint on wild Chinook impacts, that's what that package looks like in the 102. On the commercial side, there are 170 allowable impacts on wild Chinook salmon. There are no commercial fisheries directed and provided in the 102. And the fishery structure is to try to maximize the number of coho that can be caught with those 170 impacts on wild Chinook salmon. And the way that we're trying to accomplish that is through the use of tangle nets, the use of live boxes, and release of wild Chinook. So what's the deal with the change? They're correct. The public testimony was certainly correct that on March 29th there was a meeting in this room and they brought up to me a set of regulations that were predicated at, and sorry, I don't remember exactly whether I was aware of this at the time or not. But it was predicated, the Chinook release mortality rate was based on our work that we had done in the Columbia River on spring Chinook, which has a 14.7 release mortality rate, 14%. So of every, I think you know what I'm talking about. What we use in a typical gillnet fishery where they're using their typical coho gear is a 45% release mortality rate. I became pretty concerned about the use of a 14.7% release mortality rate, to the point where I thought that we should use something that was more risk adverse. And when you look at the spring Chinook fishery in the Columbia, you've obviously got much different water temperatures during the time frame that that fishery exists. The transition area from salt to fresh, where this fishery takes place just inside the mouth of Grace Harbor, was another concern. Can't quantify it. So instead of the 14.7, and you can say it's arbitrary, but it's more risk adverse, I asked staff to look at 25%. And I consulted with our science experts that had been engaged in the tanglenet fishery in the Columbia. We talked about the differences that I've mentioned, at least some of them, in terms of the conditions, water conditions, temperature, all those kinds of things, and whether or not, particularly given the history of this stock being at or below our spawning escapement goal, whether we should be using something that was more conservative. Frankly, I didn't find anybody that thought we shouldn't be using something that was more conservative within our science folks, our biologists. So the change from when they left March 29th to the meeting that Ron sponsored on April 15th was a reduction in the number of days provided for the commercial fishery, and that was a result of using a higher release mortality rate than what was modeled on March 29th. I'm not going to sit here and suggest that, particularly after hearing from people that I respect that testified here today about the engagement that they had with staff, that we couldn't have done a better job for that. But again, I don't know. Since they testified, Bob Lake gave me a call, left me a message that he was concerned about the timing, and which my response to that was to get with Jim Scott from the fish program, Ron Warren, where are we? And I knew that we were going to be, we were on the schedule that I described, that the need for the use of tangle nets in the Grace Harbor fishery was well known, and so we were continuing to push this from a timing perspective as fast as we could, but with the permanent rule process and the constraints of the permanent rule process, there was only so much we could do in terms of getting it in final form and getting it filed with Code Revisor. So, Grace Harbor, again, public hearing on the commercial fishing rules, August 6th, it's here in Olympia. I'll make sure that folks know where it is, and I can, Ron or Jim can tell me that right now if they want, if you know.
He's coming up.
Okay.
Pardon?
The public hearing is in Montesano.
Montesano, okay. And what time, Ron? Do you know?
I believe it's at 10 o'clock.
Okay, thank you.
At our office?
At our office in Montesano. And following that public hearing, then Ron and Jim are going to be coming to me, telling me what they heard, and we'll be making a final decision on the rules. And maybe we'll hear something that causes us to modify what's in the 102. That's what that public hearing's about. So maybe there's some new information that I'll hear. So looking ahead, Grace Harbor, we're going to be initiating a process to engage our stakeholders, members of the public, in the development and completion of an enhanced Grace Harbor salmon and sturgeon management framework. As you know, I have wanted to bring that to the commission, particularly those components of it which deal with allocation, which our tiered system does. And we plan to provide you an initial briefing on that enhanced plan in the fall of this year. And I would guess November, but because by December it'll be winter. So on Grace Harbor, that's where we are. Willapa Bay. This fourth area that I'll speak to, another challenging area. The management options were developed based on the Willapa Bay Salmon and Sturgeon Management Plan. The fishery planning for 2013 was focused on three conservation objectives, limiting the harvest rate on Chinook to no more than 30% on the naysail fall Chinook salmon. And you may recall that we modified our approach in managing Willapa Bay to try to achieve a self-sustaining natural population of Chinook and naysail. And while at the same time trying to manage the other systems to maximize the take of hatchery fish. On coho, to meet or exceed our conservation objective, which is a little over 13,000 coho salmon spawners in the Willapa Bay tributaries. And then relative to chum, conduct no directed fisheries and limit our incidental catch on chum through on our harvest-related mortalities to no more than 10%. Again, another extensive public process, a lot of crossover with the folks that participate in Grace Harbor and Willapa in our public processes. We met on five occasions with our Willapa Bay Advisory Group, again, convened two public meetings. The resulting proposed season structure includes a combination of retention and non-retention fisheries designed to most efficiently harvest a share of the abundant hatchery, Chinook, and coho. The structure of the commercial fishery continues to be controversial. Recreational fishers supported a net-free area from mid-August through mid-September. Recreational fishery felt that the area and time provides the best recreational fishing opportunity. The proposed rule, I have a map of or at least I had one. Oh, you have them? Do you have the copies? Okay, good. I have. I'll pause for a moment, let this come around. So part of the new management approach that we adopted for Willapa Bay included the identification of a number of additional management areas. So when I talk about 2T, you can see that that's the area adjacent to what we call washaway out to the outer boundary that depicts the separation between Willapa Bay and the ocean. And then that line that comes from Leadbitter Point to Goose Point over to Stony Point. And then it includes that North River area where the eastern boundary is just east of North River and Smith Creek. This is an area that is highly valued by the recreational fishery. We created some additional areas east of there in the Willapa River where we could have commercial fisheries that are really targeting on Forks Creek stock and as well as down there in 2N in the NEMA area. But getting back to this issue of recreational commercial conflict, our proposed rules would not open the commercial fishery in Area 2T until September 15th, except for the first opener, which is August 12th through August 15th. In addition, the proposed rules for the commercial fishery require the release of chum and wild unmarked Chinook through October 12th. And live boxes here again would be required. Soak times are limited to 45 minutes. And then in November, only the release of chum is required. No live boxes would be required in November. The recreational fishery starts on August 1, goes through January 15th. Of course, the bulk of that fishery is mid-August through mid-September. Three fish a day. They can use two rods with the two-rod endorsement. They'd be required to release wild Chinook and coho. So it's a selective coho fishery from the recreational fishery. We had a public hearing on July 23rd, and I'll be meeting with Fish Program and making a final decision on rule adoption on August 5th, which again, obviously, is this next week. I think you're aware that we've received during our public comment time frame for the CR 102 for Willapaw Bay, we've received some public comment opposing the rules that I just spoke to. So there is some opposition here as well. And I know some of that is coming from the recreational side, I believe. But I'll have an opportunity to review all that before making a decision on August 5th. So that's the update on the fisheries issues. Let me pause there before I go farther, because I'm going to shift gears and talk about fires.
Questions, commissioners? Okay, then let me ask you, the Willapa Bay Management Plan, you mentioned that you would like to bring the Grace Harbor Plan before the commission. Do you have intentions to bring the Willapa plan as well?
I need a little bit more time to think about that. My initial reaction was no, and the reason for that was we don't have that specific allocation criteria in the Willapa Bay plan that we do the Grace Harbor plan, but I want to make sure I'm right about that before I answer that with finality and talk with Jim and Ron a little bit about that and give you some thoughts on that after I have an opportunity to do that.
Okay. And you mentioned the hearing on Grace Harbor is going to be the 15th of August, and then you would make a decision after that. Do you have a time frame in mind, a day or two?
Very quickly.
Very quickly. Okay. All right.
And did we get the, one more time, just one double check, Ron, we got the date right for the public hearing for Grace Harbor?
Public hearing for Grace Harbor is August 6th.
August 6th, not the 15th.
I
didn't
write it down.
That was right.
August 6th.
Next week.
In Montesano.
Whatever.
Sorry about that.
Date that is, yeah. Okay, on to, I don't know, do I need help? Probably. I'm not going to touch anything. Love to. So I doubt that anybody in this room knows better than Commissioner Schmitten about the fires going on in eastern Washington, having experienced it up close and personal. And I'm not prepared, nor am I knowledgeable enough to provide you a complete overview of the fires that are going on in eastern Washington. But one area that I did want to speak to was had to do with the Kalaklam Wildlife Area fire, and the one that Commissioner Schmitten spoke to during his remarks earlier. This fire started at 8 o'clock in the morning. on Saturday, July 27th, in the vicinity of the intersections of the Clockham Road and the Tarpiskan Road, which is in Chelan County. Malaga, I hope I have that pronunciation correct, is near Wenatchee, and I'll show you a map here. Approximately 10 hours later, the fire descended upon our Clockham Wildlife Area headquarters, burning the barn and all of its contents. Materials lost from the fire include the wildlife area's entire cache of herbicides, signage, and wooden fence posts. That's this shot right here. That's the remnants of the building that you can see in the lower left-hand corner. As of yesterday morning, the fire had grown to about 72,000 acres, and it was reported to me that about 25% containment. The costs of controlling the fire are huge. To date, it's estimated that they've exceeded $2.5 million to fight this fire. All of our wildlife land, our wildlife area lands, the Clockham, Quillamine, Whiskey Dick, in the area have been closed to the public. Staff on the ground estimate that as much as 2/3 of the elk winter range on the Clockham has been burned, and they have already began to start thinking about what that means in the context of management strategies for this winter. So can we turn these off? I also wanted to just report back on the purchase of those Stemilt properties. You'll recall there were four parcels, two of which we were in a 50-year lease with DNR. We had entered that lease about a year ago under the assumption that we would be purchasing all four parcels. And as you may recall, the Commissioner of Public Lands, Peter Goldmark, had some concerns about the price that was going to be paid for those four parcels and his ability to maintain the trust and have it come out whole. And so we entered into some additional negotiations, which led to an agreement between the commissioner and myself, whereby we would purchase two of the four parcels, and we would relinquish or terminate the lease of the other two parcels. And when I met with you last, I anticipated that a Board of Natural Resources would approve the sale under the terms that the commissioner and I had negotiated. And in fact, when they met, they did not have sufficient votes to approve that purchase. And so we did some additional work in terms of communicating with the commissioner. The commissioner certainly stepped up and did a great job communicating with his members of his Board of Natural Resources. And at a subsequent meeting later in June, they did approve the sale of the two parcels pursuant and consistent with the terms that the commissioner and I had negotiated. And then from that point, we also terminated the leases on the other two parcels as part of that agreement. And then I also, in response to concerns that had been raised by the commission and particularly Commissioner Schmitten with the potential lease, subsequent lease of those two parcels that we released to someone who wanted to engage in agricultural practices on those parcels, wanted to ensure that if that was done, that the lessee would be responsible for the placement of sufficient fences to minimize or avoid conflict between particularly elk and the agricultural products that might be raised on that land. And I was successful in securing a letter from Commissioner Goldmark that provided that certainty. So the Stamilt property acquisition is now complete. The two parcels that we were leasing have been terminated, and so we can move forward. I have two more items. The one is longer than the other, and the more lengthy one has to do with an update on wolf management activities. So let me start with just a synopsis of our collaring activities. Since we last met in June, we have collared one additional wolf, a yearling female out of the Ruby Pack. As of back in February 2013, a total of 11 wolves had been captured. And just a summary of those is by pack is the Diamond Pack. We had two wolves that were captured in early spring in 2013 using helicopters. So the Diamond Pack now has three active collars. The Smackout Pack, we captured three wolves in early spring of 2013, again using helicopters. One of those collars has failed, so we have two collars on the Smackout Pack. Huckleberry, Spokane Indian Tribe captured two wolves using ground trapping techniques, and both of those collars are currently active. The Salmo, we have one active collar that came about as a result of success in trapping in 2012. Additional capture efforts are scheduled for this fall, and they were postponed because of the potential of grizzly bear denning in the area, and the ability to actually trap wolves was not as great with that activity co-occurring. Is Nate behind me?
Yes.
So what's the name of the, how do you pronounce the name of the Colville Pack?
The Inseaton Pack.
The Inseaton Pack? Okay, thank you. It currently has one active collar that was deployed last year, and the Colville Tribe is conducting additional efforts to collar additional members of that pack. Strawberry Pack has two active collars that were deployed last year, and again here the Colville Tribe is conducting additional trapping activities. And then one of our favorites, the Wedge Pack. Department staff has conducted a ground survey of the Wedge Pack area in July of this year. The objective of the ground survey is to locate high use areas that would give us information about where to try to put our trapping activities. No high use areas have been detected yet. Staff are continuing to monitor for wolf activities using trail cameras as well as range riders and periodic ground surveys. And then the Ruby Pack, which is a suspected pack, on July 15th, department staff captured a 68-pound yearling female wolf in the Ruby Pack area. That animal was fitted with a GPS collar. We suspect there are additional uncollared wolves in the area. We're monitoring movements of the collared animal, and we'll continue to do so for the next month or so to make sure she is not a member of the nearby Smackout Pack before we make a final confirmation of that Ruby Pack as being a separate pack. Other areas in the eastern zone. So in addition to those confirmed packs, we've also been surveying for wolf activity in other areas based on reports from the public. Department staff have surveyed for wolf activity in the Blue Mountains east and the area east of Chihuahua, the area immediately east of the Wedge. And based on those ground monitoring efforts, there wasn't evidence of a pack in the Blue Mountains other than the Walla Walla Pack that crosses back and forth between Oregon and Washington. However, there were track and photographic evidence of recent wolf activity east of Chihuahua and east of the Wedge. So staff are currently trapping in the area east of Chihuahua. And of course, as I mentioned, capture efforts east of the Wedge is scheduled for later in the year. In the North Cascades recovery zone, we have the Tianaway Pack. We'd captured three wolves there using ground trapping techniques. put collars on all three of those. One of those animals subsequently died from a cougar predation. So we've got two active collars on the Tianaway pack. The lookout pack is believed to be comprised of a breeding female, breeding male and female, and has a litter of pups. There are currently no radio collars deployed in the lookout pack. We're conducting a second capture effort this summer in that area. We're hopeful that we'll be able to capture a member of the pack in the next few days, because we've had wolves very close to our traps here very recently. And then the Wenatchee pack is believed to have two individuals. There are currently no collars deployed there. We've conducted one trapping effort earlier in the summer and is currently surveying the Wenatchee pack area for fresh wolf sign to see if we can target a second capture effort. And then in the south, our other third region of our recovery or our conservation and management plan, South Cascades Northwest Coast Recovery, we don't have any activity of or evidence of pack activity in that area. We do, as we mentioned before, we have four trapping teams, so we've doubled the number of trapping teams that we've had on the ground since we started. And in addition, as I mentioned, both the Spokane and Colville tribes have trapping teams. Turning to a depredation update, so since January of 2013, we've responded to 9 depredation reports on livestock or domestic animals. Of those 9 investigations, wolves were determined to be involved in 2. Cougar, bear, coyote, or domestic dogs were determined to be involved in the other 5, and the cause of death in the other 2 was we weren't able to determine. And then of the 2 that were related to wolves, 1 occurred back on March 10th, which involved the attack of a domestic dog, and then the second one occurred more recently on July 22nd, that came out of the wedge area. There, as the report indicates, there have been some other depredations, one of them in the wedge area that we were not able to determine the cause of death as a result of the status of the carcass, which had been 90% or more consumed. You know that we've been working hard to get livestock agreements with livestock operators that utilize non-lethal measures, have other range riders, other kinds of components, elements to them that are so there's a suite of things that a livestock operator might use. There were 16 livestock damage prevention cooperative agreements, what I'm calling agreements, signed in the time period between January and June. Many of those are being renewed for this fiscal year. So they're signed via our fiscal year that starts July 1. And in addition, we have 8 new livestock producers that have entered agreements since July 1. And then if you look at those agreements, and so what part of those agreements are where we currently have, are within areas that we currently have wolf activity, there are active agreements with livestock producers in 5 of the 10 confirmed pack areas, including the Smack Out, Wedge, Tianaway, Lookout, and Wenatchee packs. With the, you'll recall, in a Joe may have mentioned it in his update. I know I'm certainly that Owen Rowe will hear when he gets up here that the wildlife program has just done a fantastic job of gearing up in terms of staff relative to wildlife conflict. They're in the process of filling 11 conflict positions. We currently have 5 conflict specialists on staff, 3 additional specialists will start their positions over the next month, and 3 new positions have been advertised. These staff are focused solely on addressing wildlife conflict issues, obviously, including wolf conflict. We've got them spatially distributed across the state, Colville, Walla Walla, Yakima, Ellensburg, Skagit County, with upcoming positions in Okanagan, Chelan Douglas, and Chelan hyphen Douglas and Spokane counties. And we're also anticipating recruiting positions for Klickitat, Lewis, and Pierce County. So this is all part of that transfer of, or is part of the additional money that we received from the legislature to address wildlife conflict. And it's also is in part due to the fact that we were successful in getting the increase in the personalized license plate. And so a portion of that revenue is being used for this purpose. Almost done with this, and almost done, period. Wolf Advisory Group, you may recall in our Wolf Conservation Management Plan, it calls for the development of establishment of a Wolf Advisory Group. It's been formed to help guide the implementation of the plan. It consists of a 9 to 12 member citizen group with representation from a broad array of values, including representation from livestock organizations, Washington Cattlemen's Association, as well as representation from conservation organizations. And the group is going to be meeting pretty frequently, every 6 to 8 weeks, so it's going to be an active group. And then just closing on the wolf piece, I know many of you are aware or have had the opportunity to watch or at least watch a portion of the live webcast that we did back on July 18th. Big game managers from Washington, Idaho, and Montana came together to discuss experiences with managing wolves as well as deer, elk, and other big game animals that are coexistent in areas where we have wolves. We had nearly 1,000 viewers tuned in to the live webcast, and it's available on our department website. Our public affairs folks worked really hard with our wildlife program in making this happen, and they've also have updated our wolf management website and reorganized it. So if you haven't looked at that recently, I urge you to do so. So just in closing, there's a number of things coming up between this meeting and the time we'll meet next in October. Won't begin to try to list them all, but we've got a few that I'd note. We have a Pacific Salmon Commission meeting in Seattle that's primarily just for budget issues, where the Pacific Salmon Commission and the federal dollars being provided to support the commission's activity are being reduced, and so the commission is getting together to talk about how to restructure, reduce meeting costs associated with meetings. The Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, Oregon, is the host of their meeting this fall, and it's occurring in Portland beginning Sunday, September 8th, so I'm planning to attend that as well. And then on the heels of that, the Pacific Fishery Management Council meets in Boise starting Thursday, September 12th, and then shortly after that, Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission, which you'll recall includes Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California, and Idaho, is meeting in Coeur d'Alene starting Sunday, September 22nd. And I think Commissioner Carpenter mentioned the meeting that Commissioner Schmidt and I had with Billy Frank, Lorraine Loomis, Mike Graham, talking about co-management, how we can improve our co-management process relationship, and looking for setting up a meeting date that would include the full commission, or at least all of you who could make a meeting. We've struggled finding dates, not surprising. We looked at late August, we looked at September, and now we're looking at the first full week sometime during the first full week of October, which would be the week immediately following your October commission meeting. So as soon as I get a date that we'd be focusing on, I'll have Tammy get you an email and see whether or not that date might be available for you to attend. So I'm going to close there. A lot of other stuff going on this summer. We've got a lot of fisheries going on, some really excellent success, particularly up in Area 9 there, north of Everett, up to Port Townsend. They had some pretty phenomenal Chinook fishing, and we've had to cut back the limit from 2-1 there. The coast, I think it's fair to say, got off to a slow start, but it's been heating up here in the last week or so, and won't be long before fish start swimming into our estuaries and tributaries and river systems, and those fisheries will begin to crank up. And, of course, we've got our crab fishery going on in Puget Sound as well. So there's a lot of stuff happening.
Great. Thank you. Commissioner Smith.
Thanks, Phil. And maybe this is just a quick question for Nate. Is close rough count, head count on wolves in the state number?
Well, we estimate, I actually think it was 51, that we had actually seen during our winter survey time frame. You know, and we had, obviously we don't think we saw them all, certainly, and we had asked, you know, we had put it in a range of essentially 50 to 100 animals as the number of wolves that we could attribute to the winter surveys, and just making some assumptions about the number of wolves we saw versus the numbers there might be, looking at the number of packs we had, making some estimates at the total number of wolves in each one of those packs is kind of led to that range.
50 to 100, okay. And the numbered collared total? I didn't add them all.
I didn't either. Rather than me try to add them up here on the fly, I'll get you the number.
Okay.
Dave may have
you
it.
Add them up? Okay, thanks.
Okay, all right, thank you very much.
Okay, any other questions? I just want to applaud wildlife programs, activities, and gearing up so quickly. I will also applaud Ann Larson when she gets up to the front table for the superb work she did and paving the way for the increased funding that will make wolf management doable. We did seriously need that money because the conflicts are truly daunting. But back to the Wildlife Program webcast, good job. Really appreciate the expansion of efforts to do outreach. I know you've always been in the business of doing lots of outreach. The wolf situation, the wolf recovery program, just demands extensive outreach with very, very different groups, very different positions on things. So all of the information that we can transfer to the public is going to be extremely helpful, I think. And I know you've been doing a job trying to get to all the different audiences that are interested. So excellent. And lots on the plate. Thanks very much. Good job. We're reaching our break a little early, so let's take it early. Our Deputy Director Storr, do you have anything else? Okay. Then let's come back at 10:15. Thanks.
No, it's 10.